You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Welcome to another week of Side Hustle Fridays. In prior weeks, I gave 30-day book challenges. I had two episodes where I gave up to six 30-day book challenges where you could write a book in 30 days. But now, how do you make a business out of that? How do you make potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars in a single year from writing books? Very few writers do that. One writer I know, Steve Scott, has done it. When I last spoke to him, he was making $60,000 a month writing books. I spoke to him on the podcast years ago, but I dusted off that podcast and it's Side Hustle Fridays today, which is basically how to write your book, how to find the right category so it'll sell the most, how to help the other parts of your business in this spoken wheel approach by writing and publishing a book, and how to potentially make $60,000 a month writing books. So without further ado, here's the author of dozens, maybe hundreds of books for all I know by this point, Steve Scott. Steve Scott, you're living the dream, and I'll describe that in a second, but welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on again. This will be my second time, yeah.
Well, you were on 2.5 years ago, and I'll describe why you were on, but first I want to say you're kind of like the most non-famous famous person because you're always, on Amazon, you're always the number one ranked business author in the world, like always.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty interesting seeing my face above people that I respect and admire incredibly, like all the great authors I've read. It's kind of a head trip seeing all that, seeing that wow, I'm kind of, you know, outranking some of their books. So,
but you're always ranked number one for many reasons. One is the sheer amount of books you produce. Second is the number of the number of books each title sells. So you're making a good living from all these books, and you're so prolific. You keep producing these new books, but you started off just a few years ago, you had never written a book before. And how many books have you written now since then?
I would say since I began it, which is actually it's coming up my anniversary. So February 2012, I've produced 68 books, with a good amount of them being shorter books or translations or bundles. But I would say original piece of content, or at least for my habit book lines, it's at least 30 books in that so far.
So 68 books that are generating income. Like how, on a given month, how many of those titles generate at least a dollar?
I would say all of them generate at least a dollar, but there really is much the 80-20 rule, like the 20%, I'm sorry, yeah, 80% of results are generated by 20% of your effort. So there's just a few books that are just going off like gangbusters, and everything else, it's they earn just a little bit of money every single month.
So, a big question, which we'll get to, a big question is going to be, how do you get to be so prolific? Like, and from what I've read of your books and from what I've read of your courses and blogs and so on, you have very specific techniques for being so prolific. And in a sense, people who say, oh, I can't produce that amount of books, you have an answer for them. And then the other thing is, I'm always amazed at how well your books do. Like, and this is not saying anything about the quality for or against your books. It's just that your books consistently, you put out a new book and it'll consistently hit a good rank in Amazon, you know, for a good while and sell a good amount, I'm assuming, and then you put out the next book. So you have kind of techniques, I'm assuming, for getting your books to sell well. And, you know, because I'll look at other books in the category, they might not sell as well, but yours like just consistently hit number one in all of your categories. And, you know, like, again, just you don't have to answer specifics if you want, but like last month, how much did you make from books?
52,000, which is actually
last month,
so, which is weird because I think the last time we talked, it was right around there. But I would say leading up to it, there was definitely some peaks and valleys, so it was kind of up and down. But last month, it's been probably my best month in almost 3 years now.
Wow. I think you had a new book out, From Novice to Expert. So you tend to write a lot of kind of business self-help type books about habits and learning and so on and decluttering. I think you're a bestseller for a long time. Was your habit stacking book, which what's the exact title of that one?
Habit Stacking: 97 Small Life Changes That Take 5 Minutes or Less.
And that one was consistently, it was a small book and it was consistently like the number one business book. It was like always in the top, you know, let's say 300 of all books on Amazon. And I think it went as high as the top 10 several times, right?
Yeah, I think it did. But as you probably know, with Amazon, they do special promotions sometimes. So they actually put it in, I forgot what program it was. I think it was on the Prime Readership. So it was on there for a couple months, and it was just more just people picking up the copies and reading it for free than actual generating income. So it had a really high ranking.
But they paid you, though. They pay you in advance for that.
A little bit,
right.
Yeah, it wasn't too much. But it was just more just about exposure. But I'm actually excited because I'm rewriting a sequel to that. And I'm hoping to come out with that in March, early March. So that's the one. I'm like, all right, I sort of got it right the first time, but I want to make sure that the second time I really just make it as strong of a book as possible and do an actual proper launch and try to make it as big a success as I guess I possibly can.
Okay, when you say proper launch, well, we're going to have to unpack that a little bit because clearly you're doing something right with your launching. I mean, really what my goal is here is I sort of feel like you're living the dream life. Like you can essentially stay at home, write these books. You're very prolific, but you have techniques for being prolific. And like I said, you have techniques for kind of marketing these books, and you're making a living writing. You don't have a boss necessarily.
Nope.
And you diversify the income across many titles, and you'll keep on writing. So this could potentially be a source of growing income for you for the rest of your life, doing exactly what you love doing.
Exactly. That is the plan.
Like, are you a happy guy when you wake up in the morning?
Actually, I am. Since we last talked, I got married. My son was born in April.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even know. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Are you going to write a book about parenting?
Not yet. I've actually been asked, what about parenting habits? But my mornings, I just spend in the morning. I do a little bit of like, just kind of like, I guess what Carl Newport would call shallow work. So I'll spend the morning just answering emails or doing just book marketing campaigns. And in the afternoon, once I stop taking care of him, I drop him off at a daycare. And I just spent about 4 or 5 hours just really just hyper-focused on just the writing and stuff. And
That's so interesting. Like, I tend to write in the morning because I feel that's when I'm most creative.
Me too.
So I feel like the morning is for making and the afternoon is for managing. So that's
totally
when
agree.
I do all the emails and marketing and things like that.
Well, I totally agree, but it's just reality.
You
I
have take life a, circumstance.
I have to take it in the morning, but if I had it my way, I would definitely be just writing first thing in the morning because I totally agree. It's first thing in the morning before you open email, before you look at Facebook, you sit down and you write 30 to 60 minutes and just don't do anything else. And I set a timer. Actually, you mentioned before about the habits. You kind of want me to go into a little bit about like how to actually get this done on a daily basis.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
'Cause you, it seems like you've written, I don't know how many books about habits, but quite a few books about basic habits. And again, you're up against some hardcore books like The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg, who's also been a guest on this podcast, and many other great books about habits, but you're just crushing it in the habits category.
So it's for me, it's just I understand how my mind works and what my natural lazy kind of procrastination tendencies are. So I know if I leave writing to the end of the day, it might not be as good or I might not get to it or it might not do the amount that I really want to. So I used to write first thing morning. Now I have to do it first part of the afternoon. But it really is a disciplined technique where I sit down. I'm a firm believer in a Pomodoro technique. So I just set my timer for 25 minutes. And it really is hyper-focused 25 minutes. If I stop to look at something or you know, look outside to check out the squirrels, I have to stop the timer and just start over. So I kind of punish myself for not following through with that
and
habit.
Is there a science behind that? Like, is it shown, like, in 25-minute focused spurts and then I think it's like a 5-minute break? Mm-hmm. Is there research that shows that's the best way to be productive?
I've looked at the research, and I think it's an individual basis. Like, I know that for me, once I start hitting 30 to 40 minutes, I really start losing my focus, whereas some people are able to concentrate for a full 40 to 50 minutes. It really is on—
But
I guess,
somewhere around there, and then
somewhere.
You need to walk around, or—
Yep. I actually try to get 250, so it's another habit. I try to stand up, get 250 steps, walk around my house, just get a little bit away from the computer, and then sit back down. Write for another 25 minutes. And I try to follow that at least 3-4 times during a writing block. And actually, I'm anal retentive enough where I track this all in an Excel spreadsheet. And I track the location, what I'm working on, what draft it is. And with the calculation in Excel spreadsheet, it actually shows me like my average word count per session at that location. And at the end of the day, this kind of gives me a rough idea of where I'm most productive, when I'm most productive, and how I can kind of get in the zone.
That's really funny. Like, you know, I used to do something like that for investing. So I decided I was writing software to kind of look at patterns in stocks going up and down and what the best days were to trade certain stocks.
Nice.
So I decided to track my own P&L, like how much money I was making on every day as if I were a stock. And so then I could know whether to bet against myself or not. So for instance, let's say I always lost money on a Friday, or let's say I always lost money on the first day of the month, I would have to, you know, maybe not trade those days. Like, it would give me extra information. And it's one of the very few times I've done the quantified self thing, but it sounds like it's useful for you. Like, what's the best location for you to work in?
For me, it is Starbucks in the afternoon in Midland Park. That to be very hyper-specific, it's just one particular Starbucks location, and I've vetted maybe 15 of them in Bergen County. And for some reason, that's the one place where I just seem to get in the zone. And unfortunately, I can't do it in the morning like I used to, but I find that just 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock at that specific location, I get the highest amount of words done.
And I want to get down into the nitty-gritty of how you pick a category, how you decide what the book's going to be. But it strikes me that you write, obviously you're putting out a book every couple of weeks, it seems, or every month, or whatever the rate is. It's a very fast rate. So you're probably writing many words a session, let's say between 2,000 and 5,000 words a session, I'm guessing.
Actually, it's a lot less than that.
Really?
I would say my production now is it's around the 2-month mark. I've actually tried to really slow down the production schedule, but try to make each book a little bit better than the previous one. And also, I'm starting to build a website and also an email sequence for each book. So,
oh, and that's the other thing you've been doing since the last time we've spoken. It seems like your business has expanded. So you're not just depending on income from just these books. You now have kind of a community around what you're doing and on the concept of self-publishing. So you have courses on self-publishing and so on. So it seems like you're kind of like branching out, you're diversifying your different revenue streams.
Kind of, sort of. I tried that and now I'm actually decided to completely take a step back from the teaching stuff. Like this is probably one of the last interviews I'm going to do or conversations I'm going to have about how to self-publishing. Because I find that the building a business around books is just, it's more profitable. I'm a lot less stressed if I only have to worry about one business instead of two businesses. And honestly, I'm trying to emulate what you're doing. You have a fantastic audience. You have a super loyal following. And I like how on Facebook you post a little bit of the content you're probably going to put into a book. People respond to it. So it seems like you're almost vetting a certain idea. I'm trying to do the same thing where I have an audience and I'm just continuously talking to them, promoting or publishing little pieces of content and just see how they respond to that. And that's probably what I'm going to try to do moving forward with my books, is just test the idea first instead of just going out writing 20, 30,000 words on it and then realizing that the idea doesn't sell as well as I thought it would.
So like, for instance, one way, like let's take that habit stacking, like 97 habits to, what, I forget the subtitle again.
Small life changes. I forget myself sometimes.
97 small life changes. You could potentially just write a list of the 97 and post it on Facebook and see what the engagement is like versus other posts. And if it's very high, then you could just flesh out those 97 into chapters, and now you have a book.
Exactly. And I think there's something to be said about trying an idea, getting feedback from an audience first, seeing people actually be interested in the idea before you go out and try to write it. And some of my biggest missteps in my business, like I did write one book that was complete failure.
What was the book?
The Accountability Manifesto. And I was like, oh, it's about accountability. It's about, like, you know, checking in with other people, making sure that you're doing well with what you need to do well with. But I think the word accountability has a negative connotation where it's more like holding a business accountable.
Yeah.
And I don't think people really kind of got the message. And I tried to change it to the Accountability Manifest. No, it was crowdsource your success. I tried to change it to have a little bit more benefit driven, but it didn't really matter.
That must have worked better though, crowdsource your success.
It was a flop both ways and it just completely tanked. And I think I just made my money back on that one about a month or so ago. So there were some serious missteps. And
well, what do you mean you made your money back? Like, and again, I want to kind of go through the whole process, but what are your expenses when you make a book?
It's usually now in the $2,000 to $3,000 range. So that you could tell that book did not do well at all. Mm-hmm. But that's for first line editing, second line editing, formatting for both print and ebook, the audiobook version. And I think that's it. I think it's like one last proofread. So I try to spend more time making sure the content's as good as it can possibly be. And also there's a little bit post-production costs. And also if you throw in advertising, sometimes that can add up to $1,000 or so for like the actual launch of the book.
I do want to ask you about advertising because I'm very interested in that. But so it seems like a really, and you've written about this, a really important strategy is to outline. And I find for myself, if I outline versus, if I don't outline, sometimes I tell a better story. But if I do outline, I can write many more words around many more different concepts in one session. So do you find that? I'm just trying to figure out your basic disciplines.
100%. So whenever I have a book idea, I kind of think about a book idea and then it's usually almost a month or 2 months till I actually get started with writing it. But during that time, I'm reading about the topic. I'm trying to learn as much as I can in addition to what I already know. I put all that in just this giant like sheets of paper. It usually comes out to be about 20, 30 handwritten sheets of paper about the topic.
Wow. But, so, like, and a lot of that is like outline driven?
Kind of outline driven. It's more like what I call just a brain dump. Just completely, just put it on paper as much as possible. Then take the handwritten notes, put it into index cards. And actually, like, I have usually a stack of like, I would say 100 to 200 index cards. And that's the actual order of the book. And I'm just constantly sorting it, ripping up index cards, trying to put it in some like you described, some sort of step-by-step process that actually follows a narrative flow. And then from there, I actually just type out what's on the index cards into an outline, and then the outline becomes the basis for my rough draft. And even from there, I'm constantly trying to edit and tweak. And I'm also trying to add in like different passes. So after the first draft, I actually sit down and structurally edit and look at, all right, maybe this section should belong there. So instead of just going started with the second draft, now I take a couple day pause and just look at what I have and try to restructure it there.
But you're always working on like a couple different books at a time, so you can kind of go from one project to the other. Whenever you feel blocked on one project, you kind of go to another one. So it's interesting, like when you make these index cards, let's say you make 200 index cards, one thing I learned from you by looking at your books and the success of those books is you've sort of help change the definition of what a book is. Because typically, like if you publish a book with like a major publisher, they're going to say, okay, deliver us 60,000 words in, you know, a year. But you've flipped that completely. Like you put out, most of your books are between 15 and 25,000 words, right? Would you say?
It's gotten more now to 20 to 30, but same thing. It's just pretty short books.
Yes, pretty short books, but you'll price them. I mean, you price them the same as, let's say, I'll price mine. I'll have, you know, I probably make my books too big, and your books are all, you know, Amazon bestsellers. So it's sort of like this idea that, you know, catering to the fact that people have so many things competing for their attention, let's give them a book that satisfies, you know, the fact that there's a lot more competition for their attention. Here's a smaller book.
Yeah, exactly. I do enjoy a really lengthy book, and I know you interviewed him, Tim Ferriss specifically, his Tools of Titan. I love it. It's a nice, long,
that's a brilliant book,
meaty book.
Yeah,
it's a great book. But also, there's some books, like there's an author, Monica Lionel. She wrote How to Dictate Your Book, and I just want to know, how do I dictate my book? I don't need 60,000 words. I need to know how to get started, how to get better at it, and what tools I need
right.
to buy.
Right, so she can make a book like that and basically sell it for 99 cents. Why wouldn't someone pay less than a dollar to figure out everything you need to know to dictate your book so you could publish a book? And what a great idea. How many words is that?
I think it was on the longer side. I think she priced at $299 or $399, and it was in the, I would say, 20,000 word range. It was right to the point. And what I loved is she didn't waste her time, and I try to emulate the same thing, where just get to the point, like make sure you're providing as good content as possible, and then get out. You don't need the 20,000 word preamble about how this is important. You kind of just explain a little bit about why it's important and just
right.
Make every chapter.
You make every chapter, and I'm sorry I interrupted just there.
No worries.
You make every chapter as actionable as possible.
I try to. I feel the one thing I'm lacking is good personal stories, which you do beautifully. I don't include enough of me in the books. And that's, I'm trying to make that change, but also in the back of my mind, I also think, well, a few personal stories here and there are good, but I don't want to get into the which I made a mistake in the previous years, where get into the routine where I'm writing these 35, 40,000 word books that don't quite go anywhere. I want to make sure that they're just kind of focused on what people are buying the book.
Right. Particularly if you're like focusing on a category like, you know, declutter your life or habits or, you know, success rules or whatever it is you're writing about. Or your most recent one is From Novice to Expert, which is kind of a pathway to learning and, mm-hmm. you know, bring stuff from deliberate practice and other learning techniques. And that's doing pretty well. I forget what that's ranked at right now.
This is a little bit of an asterisk. It's ranked, last time I checked, number 33 overall. But when you and I
Which
were talking,
incredible.
About, yeah, it's doing pretty well. But it was also like a random Amazon promotion happened yesterday. Yesterday it happened the last day of the month. So that doesn't normally happen to me. So I think before that it was ranked at 1,100 overall, which is still, I'll still take it. It was still doing pretty well. And then,
yeah, particularly if that's one among 60 titles, you know, you're pulling revenue. Like if it's ranked 1,000, and I know we're going all over the place, but if it's ranked 1,000 on Amazon, how many copies a month is that, would you say?
It was around 80 to 100 a day. So I would say maybe 2,500 to 1,000, 2,500 to 3,000 copies a month.
And just to get technical, on Amazon, if you price something at $299 and it's self-published, you're essentially making $2.10 per copy sold.
Yeah, it's roughly that. I think they charge me a little bit of download fee because I have a few pictures in there, but it is in the $2 range.
So okay, let's say I'm sitting at home and I'm listening to this and I'm like, man, that sounds great. How do I start off? I've never written a book. How do I pick a topic? You have a lot of interesting thoughts on that. Like, how do you go, how should someone go about picking a topic?
Okay. Well, I would say first thing before anything else, do understand this is a long-term business. And I feel I haven't said that message enough to people, but—
No, I want to just get rich quick here.
It's not. It's the exact opposite, get rich quick. But it is, if you focus on it, it is a profitable business model. But I would say from the first kind of go around, you want to make sure that you're talking about what you're interested in. So some of the courses that I've taught, we call it the three P's of self-publishing. So there's passion— passion, personal experience, and profitability. So you want to, if you picture in your mind a Venn diagram, so you want to make sure that the topic is going to make money, but you also want to make sure that you're genuinely interested in the topic, or you at least have the desire to learn more about the topic where you can write a pretty good book about it, and also some personal experience. So you can't just go out and write about Forex trading if you've never done it before. I wouldn't recommend doing that because you could give disastrous advice that could cause someone to go bankrupt. So you definitely want to make sure you have something in the middle of all three.
How do you know a topic's going to be profitable?
I use what I call like the rule 30,000. So you go on to Amazon, you just look at the bestsellers ranking of every book, make sure you're searching by the Kindle store. And every single book has what they call an Amazon or BSR, Amazon bestsellers ranking. So just scroll down to the product details page and just find a ranking for a book. And if you could find a couple books that are under 30,000 or less, for me, that's just a good starting point of, all right, this is a good book idea. I know it's going to sell. And that's around 5 to 10 copies a day.
So let's just understand that a little more. So let's say I'm interested in golf or whatever. Let's just pick golf randomly. I'll go to the golf category, and maybe golf will have subcategories. I don't know, like teaching golf, biographies of golf professionals, best golf courses in the world. So maybe there's a bunch of categories under golf fiction. And then I'll look at each category and I'll see, well, which category has a number of books that are ranked below 30,000, meaning they sell more. And then that shows me there are definitely buyers in this category.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would go as granular as possible and how to improve your swing. You're going to see in a couple of seconds how I know nothing about golf. So I'm going to try to roll with this though. But how to improve your swing, how to putt better, I guess.
So you can do a whole book. You would divide it up as granular as possible, and you would write a whole book on how to putt better.
How to putt better. That would be one book.
So let's even take that further. So let's say in the category of putting, we've seen that there's several books that are below 30,000. So it means that there's buyers. And let's say you have some personal stories about golfing and how you improved your own, putt swing. Would you then go and interview a bunch of people, or how would you then do your research?
That's tricky. I'm a firm believer you should have some expertise in it, or at least a willingness to go on interview. So the one website that I like to use if I really just don't know a lot, and it's usually just one small section of a book. I don't try to go out and write a book I know nothing about.
Right.
But I would go to Help a Reporter Out, and that's just a website that kind of aggregates journalists and people that are willing to kind of be knowledge experts and just submit something saying, hey, I'm writing a book about how to improve your putt. Would you mind if I interviewed you? And you'll get 10 to 20 to 30 people to respond back. They'll say I'm such and such credentials with golf. Again, I know nothing about golf. I have such and such credentials with golf. I can be available for a 30-minute interview, or you can just actually leave questions and help a reporter out. People will just respond back to them. And from there, maybe you just check their credentials and then you set up a time and you can interview these people. That would probably be my approach if I really just knew nothing and I wanted to find people who know a good amount. Or you can just find people who have good content platforms, good blogs, podcasts, that sort of thing, and maybe ask to borrow a little bit of their time. Now, obviously, there has to be some sort of exchange of like what's in it for them. So maybe you could offer to promote their website. But there are knowledge experts out there. If you really just know nothing about a subject, you can find people who you can interview and include in the book.
It strikes me also that once you kind of, you've kind of done a lot of books, obviously in the habits category, we've spoken about that, but it seems like it's easy now to combine popular categories. So for instance, you've done these 97 habits for success. We also know another category that might be popular is, let's say, Donald Trump. Like, he dominates the news cycle, obviously. You could almost make a half-joking, half-serious book, like, the 27 Habits of Donald Trump, or, something like that. Would you ever do something where you combine a sort of news cycle-worthy idea with your basic content?
I like the idea. I also just kind of intuitively know the Amazon marketplace. I think something like that, you're going to get a lot of negative reviews. So I would say anything that's really polarizing, I'm trying to think. Something like Donald Trump is extremely polarizing.
But a lot of negative reviews might be good, right? Like sometimes if a book has a lot of one-star reviews and five-star reviews, those are often the best-selling. And I'm thinking like 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right about that. Me personally, I would probably avoid it, but I'm not saying it's a bad idea. It's just something that I know that there's a certain type of audience and you're right. There'll be completely rabid readers who will absolutely love it, and then there'll be the liberals who will rip it apart, and that'll make the rabid conservatives more happy. So I can see how that would work. Just for me, something that's news cycle, it doesn't seem like it would last as long as possible. And I try to find what they call evergreen topics that I'll write in 2012 and it still has a chance of doing well in 2017. So that's my personal preference. I don't think what you said is a bad idea. Just I would personally avoid it just for a number of reasons.
So let's make it more evergreen. How about the 40 habits of the 40 richest people in the world? So the Definitely. 40 habits of billionaires.
That's kind of like Think and Grow Rich. And that's a perfect example of something that was written many, many years ago and is still doing well because it is very evergreen. He just did interviews with a bunch of the richest people at the time and created a pretty good book from that. So,
you know, like here's another one. I've written a lot recently about minimalism, and so these have all been popular posts. Marie Kondo's book, The Magic Art of Tidying Up, is a very successful book on minimalism, sold 2 million copies in Japan, sold a lot here. The Minimalists had a documentary on Netflix.
Oh, I love that one, yeah.
So what about something like, the 40 top habits of minimalists or something like that?
I would say, yeah, that's definitely a slam dunk. And what I've also learned is this might be creating my own competition, but you put the word habits and routines in any title, it'll probably sell because it's just something that people tend to gravitate towards because they have the mindset, well, even if I develop one or two of those, it's still one or two of those habits, it's definitely a win for me. So I do find that those type of books will absolutely sell really well.
So we've probably identified like four or five books here, like the 30 Habits of Jedi Masters or something like that.
Yeah, if only Disney wouldn't sue me over that one. But
well, I wonder if Disney is, can they, like you're allowed to say the word Jedi in a book?
I think so, but they have a lot, they have billions of dollars. I don't want to find out the hard way that right. I'm using their trademark thing. So I'm pretty sure you could do parody. Parody is completely legal. You could do just a riff off of a book and make fun of it. But I'm not too sure where the line is. And
right.
I frankly don't want that.
So you
kind
play
of
it safe.
I play everything very, very vanilla safe as possible.
So you find a topic using this technique, then you get as granular as possible, and you can make as long as it satisfies that 30,000 rule, you can write a book on each granular topic.
Definitely, and. The one application of 30,000 rule is you don't necessarily have to go out and try to find a specific topic that's under 30,000. As long as you know that there's a market, I used a golf example before. Even if I didn't see a couple of books that had how to putt better under 30,000, I would still probably go out and try to write that book if I saw that there's just a bunch of general golf books under that ranking. And just off the top of my head, I know golf is just a massive topic and people absolutely love it. But so I would say look more at the market instead of the individual book topics and try to be as creative and unique with the individual book topics as possible.
Okay, so like let's say, for instance, golf is a super popular category, but there's no books on putting. That would be one thing that was interesting to you. Even you wouldn't scare you off if there were no books on putting because you know anything with golf might be popular.
Absolutely.
Well, what other, and again, neither you or I know anything about golf probably, but like what's some other golf topics that would come to you right away?
How to slice, how to reduce your slice, I guess. That's the thing where you I'm terrible at this, where the ball goes way to the right or left, how to eliminate your slice or how to take a couple strokes off your overall game. Maybe the best, like you mentioned before, the best golf courses, the 10 best golf, that I guess that's more of a BuzzFeed type of article, something about the best, how to find the best golf course, or that's a limit of my golf knowledge.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes has arrived in IMAX.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
There's this guy who's trying to do the 10,000 hours in golf. He started off with 0 ability in golf.
Really?
And he's like on hour number 5,000 now. And he's almost like, not quite, but almost professional level. So he's trying to put in the full 10,000 hours. And it'd be interesting to see, like, again, what his habits are, how he's doing the so-called deliberate practice of the 10,000 hours, and just basically itemize those and make a book out of it.
That's incredible. Is that a blog or is that a...
I you know who told me about this was Stephen Dubner, who wrote Freakonomics, and he's really into golf. And he mentioned this to me because we were speaking on another podcast about learning.
So, I love that because it takes an idea and actually puts it into real world practice. And you could see how he went from pretty much knowing nothing to mastering it.
Well, and a couple of people have done that. Like Josh Foer did that with Moonwalking with Einstein, where he did essentially 10,000 hours to become the U.S. memory champion from scratch. He was a reporter covering it, and then he said, oh, I'm going to do it. And he enlisted the help of Anders Ericsson, who's the expert on the 10,000-hour rule, and wrote this book, and it was a New York Times bestseller. It's an interesting book. And but you're right. Those kind of habits, routines, learning, all of these things tend to be successful. What are other categories that you've thought about?
Categories of, like, being able to write in?
Yeah, that you think would be profitable.
I would say the finance category does pretty well, but you have to be at the top of your game. You can't just write just a personal finance. Like you said, the minimalism category, that does pretty well. Off the top of my head, I'm struggling to come up with business ones. Definitely do well. Social skills. I know my friend Patrick King, he does really well.
Oh, yeah,
social skills.
See his books always advertised. Like he just wrote one, The Art of the Witty Banter.
Yeah.
So and he's written some others like about social confidence and so on. How many has he written? Because he kind of follows your formula a little bit.
He does, but there's so many things he does way better than I do. Like if you ever read his product descriptions, he understands copywriting immensely. He just does a really incredible job with actually presenting the book and why you need to buy it. So if you ever need to study good copywriting for Amazon, just check out Patrick King's books. But I think he's in the 20 to 30 book range at this point. He's way more prolific than I am. He's a former lawyer, so I know he just has a lot of experience with writing a lot in a short amount of time.
So he churns them out, and would you say he's now primarily making a living from his books?
Oh, absolutely.
Like he quit his job as a lawyer?
I know he's been self-sustaining with his books in the last couple of years. And I think he does do coaching, but I feel he almost uses coaching as a way to information gathering to get ideas for his book. So it's more of a impromptu, a little bit on the side. And he told me once that he almost uses the words that people tell him about the struggles that they're going through and uses it in his copy and also the next ideas for his book. So,
well, it's good storytelling.
Exactly.
To get all the different testimonials and so on. So okay, there's finding kind of the profitable topic idea that you're also passionate about and you have some personal experience with. It's the three P's you talked about. And then there's kind of this month or two period where you do a brain dump and kind of list and then outline as much research as possible. Then there's the writing about it. And then there's a lot of blogs out there about how the technical how-tos of self-publishing, so people can go to those, and they can even go to your site, and then you have some checklists. But what do you do then? Like, how do you then make something have as much chance as possible of being a bestseller? Because obviously, you put your all into each book.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those answers that's hard to answer because it really is the rich get richer in a way. Like, the bigger the platform you have, the better you're going to do, and that's just the reality of it. I would say, though,
but you started off with zero platform.
I did. I started off with a little bit of following in the internet marketing space. I wrote some internet marketing specific books just because I was an affiliate marketer for many years before I got into self-publishing.
What does affiliate marketer mean?
If you have a website like a blog or a podcast and you promote a product and all these websites want you to promote their product, in exchange they'll give you a sales commission. So it's almost like being an online sales commission. So you promote the product Blinkist. I use Blinkist all the time. And if someone goes and buys it, you get 25% of whatever the cut was. So really the percentage really varies on each individual program. But what a lot of business models that are out there, they just have these giant websites that have a lot of content and they promote specific products. And if people click on a link and buy a product through that, they get a sales commission. So people, just like with self-publishing, people are able to make a full-time income through affiliate marketing. So
let me ask you a question. Here's an idea for you. Why don't you write the 25 best drones of 2017. And, you know, those are expensive, high-priced items on Amazon. And you get, so you combine your book skills with your affiliate skills.
There's a small wrinkle to that. Amazon specifically says you can't put affiliate links in books, PDFs, and what's the other one? It's book PDFs. Oh, and emails. So they're really making sure that you don't go out and do that. An idea, though, is you could have a good book, but then also direct people back to your blog and also have affiliate links on your blog. And that's actually, I do a little bit with that with my books. If I like a certain product, I'll say, well, here's a review of a few of my top choices. Go send them back to my blog. And then I do have affiliate links on my blogs for certain products. But the percentages on Amazon, they're not great. They're in the 8% of whatever the sales price is. And it's also a 24-hour cookie for anything that people buy. So if someone buys a journal on your website and it goes out and buys a HD flat screen TV, you also get the sales commission on that. So it's not a great percentage, but also the fact that you're promoting something on Amazon. Yeah, it's massive.
So okay. So now you've launched the book. And I know let's say someone, it's their first book, but their plan is, oh, I'm gonna follow Steve Scott's success, mm-hmm. and I'm gonna write 5 books, 10 books, 20 books. What do I start doing with the very first book to give it as big a chance as possible for success?
Okay, definitely. The first thing you absolutely need to do, and it's going to be more writing or more product creation, is you want to create what's called a lead magnet. And other people call it reader magnets. I just call it lead magnet just because that's the way I was taught. It's just a free piece of content that you give out to your readers in the front of your book and also the back of your book. And if you can get away with it, inside the middle of your book. And the idea of this free piece of content is it adds value to whatever they're reading. So if it's they're reading a book on habits, this is maybe a habit checklist or a quick video or something else.
So it's something that's on your website that they have to sign up for.
Exactly. And they sign up to your email list. And then from there, you almost want to build what they call a nurturing sequence where you send them a few emails, you introduce yourself as an author, you provide more value. And the idea here is they just go from random reader into someone who is a loyal following. And I think you do this great, James. You have just so many people that are just rabid followers of you. And that's the idea there, is you want to turn your readers into people that will become one of your 1,000 true fans.
But I think it's very innovative that you put kind of a link to your email list right in the book. I've never done that, and I think that's actually very a good idea.
Yeah, and it has to be like, what's in it for me? You have to answer that question for the reader.
What you give away.
Yeah, you give away, and then you also do try to provide value. And honestly, I think that's the first step in publishing, and it won't. There's almost no immediate benefit from that, but you can put a review link in one of your emails. Say, hey, if you like the book, can you go leave a review? But the idea here is every time you come out with a book, you're building that asset, and I really do believe email marketing is the biggest asset that's out there. And that's how when you launch a book, you have tens of thousands of people on your email list. You email them, say, hey, the book's ready, go buy it here. And if you time it correctly, and I would love that we could talk about the launch sequence, because I think that's probably the biggest secret.
So you launch the book.
Yeah, so you launch the book, and this is kind of on the idea that you have a platform, and maybe after this I can talk about how to build a platform. But you launch a book, and what I've learned from Amazon, if you just flood Amazon with sales in one day, then you won't really get any traction. Amazon will see the ups and downs, and they're like, all right, that's a book that surged, but we're not really going to do anything. But if you continuously hit Amazon, then eventually Amazon will say to itself, all right, this is a book that people are buying. People seem to like it. So let's kind of do some promotion on our end. So they'll do email marketing campaigns. Your book will go on the top 100 new releases list. And if you pick the right category, sometimes you'll have like the number one new release in that category. It'll be also on the customer also bought. So whenever you look at a book on Amazon, you see here's books that are similar to that. And if you do a good enough job during the launch, just Amazon will promote it everywhere. So what I've kind of learned, especially over the last couple of years, is once you launch a book, you really have to time this in a real specific sequence. So email list one day, and actually I've gotten to the point where I split my email into two or three different parts. So I'll email one part of my list on one day, another part of my list on a second day, another part of my list on a third day.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Like I always thought, when you launch on, let's say, February 1st, hit everything on February 1st, nope. So it goes as high as possible on Amazon.
I guess you could get like what they call the vanity metric of, all right, I achieved like the number 40 overall, but long-term, I don't see the benefit versus just spreading it out. And I really do mean like it's a 7 day, so it's like email lists. I'm almost emailing a different segment of my list for a different reason on every single day. And then you add in social media campaigns. So if you have a Facebook group or another following, you promote it there and also on my blog. And what I'm doing with Habit Stacking 2.0, which tentatively that's what I'm calling it, is I'm also reaching out to anyone that I know that I've like kind of built relationships over a couple of years and just making it as brain dead simple for them as possible to promote the book and just say, hey, I'll owe you a big time for forever if you do this for me. And it's pretty much me begging a bunch of people that I know to promote the book on my behalf, but I'm also trying to make it like...
And there are people who also have big platforms and...
Yes, and it's not necessarily just people with big platforms, but people that I feel... there's some relationships, so I'm not just emailing someone out of the cold. It's people that know me and like me and trust me. And I to throw that in for the launch sequence, I'll try to drip those out as much as possible. So as far as a launch, you really want to hit as many different spots on different days as much as possible instead of just blasting it all in one day, because you really don't have any follow-through with after day one. If you have nothing to kind of back it up on day two, day three, day four, day five, then Amazon will kind of see that and be like, all right, I guess no one really wants this book. So it's almost like you have to prove to Amazon it's worth promoting.
And not Amazon, like people, but like the algorithm.
The algorithm. But there are actually, what I'm starting to realize is there are actual decision makers behind Amazon. It's not just algorithm based. So I think also what you and I have done well is we've also tried to build personal relationships with some people at Amazon as well. And I think just trying to help them out as much as possible, I think that factors into that a little bit, but I can't really put I can't quantify that.
So, but let's say I don't have a platform and I'm just starting. What should I do?
So this is where it gets a little bit difficult. So same thing as before, you want to release a book, and I would recommend launching a book for free at this point instead of trying to sell it, just because if no one knows you, you're really not going to, it won't be heard that the book will get launched and then no one will see it. But if you give away for free and you have a good enough cover, good enough description, something that's really compelling, and you promote the free promotion, and with Amazon, if you give away a book for 5 days, they let you give away a book for 5 days, and that's just a way that if you get enough free downloads, eventually when it goes to paid, then you'll get a good amount of exposure.
Well, why is that? Does your free ranking carry over to the paid ranking?
Slightly. It used to be in 2010 and 11, it used to work like gangbusters, where as soon as it went from free to paid, it would just stick. Now you almost have to get within a top couple hundred overall with the free category for it to make any difference in the paid. But I do find that getting a lot of people to download your book and join your email list, that pays dividends down the road. Now, in addition to that, and this is where it gets difficult.
When you're – sorry to keep interrupting, but it's so fascinating, all the details of this, and people can actually achieve this. Like, you've demonstrated it at Patrick King, many other – I've seen many others since you've started kind of follow your path. Like, almost – their books almost look like your books. Like, I think, did Steve write that? And then I realized, oh, no, someone else wrote it.
I know some similarities.
Yeah. So, okay, when you launch a book for free, obviously many more people download it than – the equivalent rank is paying for it. So, like, number 1,000 in the overall Amazon store for free, how many downloads a month is that getting? Or, in the five-day period?
I'm going to be very honest. I have no idea because I haven't launched a book for free in, I would say, almost 3 or 4 years now. Mm. My rough estimate is I would say you need in the neighborhood of at least 10 to 20,000 downloads for it to really stick. And that's
a lot because
that's a lot.
the equivalent sales will almost never happen.
Yeah, there's almost no way that they equate each other. So it's more just about as getting as much exposure as possible. And then it is a tough slog. And that's why I said at the top of this interview that you have to be prepared for long-term success. So it's almost you launch a book and then you go back to writing the second and third one. But also at the same time, I would highly recommend doing two additional things. So build some sort of platform where you can communicate with people. So a blog, a podcast, or a YouTube channel where people see you providing good free content. That doesn't mean that you have to create unique content. You could pretty much take the same principles from your book and put it into a YouTube video or a podcast, or you could do vice versa, where you could take your content from these platforms and put it into a book. So it's not like you're having to do a lot of extra work. But the idea here is you want to just narrowly focus on one topic and just provide good free value to your audience, and that will pay dividends down the road. Again, it's a tough slog, but if you continuously publish books and also build good content, then you will build that 1,000 true fans that will eventually turn into people who buy and review your books. And then I would say one additional thing beyond that is to try just at least one social media platform. So it really depends on your strengths and where your audience is. So it could be Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, Snapchat. And the reason I say just one is because I think people try to do too many things all at once and they just go nowhere. They just spin their wheels on all these different platforms. But for me, I stick to just a couple of things. I try to do a couple of things well instead of trying to be on Twitter. Like I haven't checked my Twitter feed in 2 years. I just don't really care anymore. And I think
you do Facebook very well.
I'm trying. I'm dedicating, and it really is like 30 minutes. That's it. 30 minutes a day to Facebook. I'm trying to get better at it. But if I'm on any platform, it's Facebook, just because it's also I'm able to connect with a lot of my writing friends and online friends. It's more of a personal / business. But I don't try to do other platforms.
But I think to add to what you just said, it's probably also very valuable to leverage someone else's platform, and in Facebook is pretty good for that.
Definitely.
So you have a group on Facebook, for instance, your self-publishing group, where everybody's on there interested in self-publishing, and there's thousands of members of the group, I believe. So I could go on there and just basically be a helpful participant on every conversation that takes place, and gradually your entire group knows who I am if I do that enough. And I'm saying it could be anybody.
Yeah, actually, what you just said would be the exact advice I would give to anyone who has nothing at all, is to join, I would say, just one or two groups. Don't try to join 20 groups. Find one or two groups, but make sure there are active groups where people are just continuously publishing content, asking questions, that sort of thing. And just like you described, get in there and be that awesome person who sits and helps them as much as possible.
Well, and a great example of this, by the way, is E.L. James, who initially self-published 50 Shades of Grey. She was active in all sorts of Twilight, you know, fan fiction groups social media. And so that audience was her initial audience that bought 50 Shades of Grey. She was totally self-published, sold 250,000 copies, and then was picked up by a major publisher.
Yeah, I knew her book took off. I didn't realize that she was that active. That's a perfect example we just said.
Yeah, she was writing Twilight fan fiction. That's how it all started. And then she turned that into 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, I've never read nor seen the movies, but I know that like she kind of came out of nowhere and did the Twilight thing, and I guess she had to change the whole thing around because of potential trademark stuff. But she's a great example of someone who just came out of nowhere and built a massive following just from those couple of books.
Do you think someone can use these techniques as a fiction writer? I mean, the problem a little bit is writing the 60 books.
Yeah.
Fiction seems like it would be harder to be that prolific, but maybe not. I don't know.
Fiction, actually, I would say all the stuff I use in nonfiction, I just kind of took the principles of fiction and just morphed it into my own little thing with nonfiction. I would say with fiction, it takes longer to get going, but once you actually have those people who buy your books, I would say it's more sustainable than nonfiction. Because with nonfiction, there's a bunch of random book topics that often don't really blend well into each other. But if you write a 10-book series and you do a good enough funnel with the first book or two that gets people interested in your story, they'll go out and they'll buy 10 books. And I know I've done it myself. I bought 10 books by this one author because I'm like, oh, it's a good vampire story, and just kept on reading. They're pretty consumable. They're a quick pace. And next thing you know, I probably spent 30, 40 bucks with this one book line. And I'm sure there's lots of other stories like that where fiction writers get someone in their funnel and they just go out and buy their entire catalog. So,
well it's interesting because let's go back to the 1,000 True Fans. So that's come up quite a bit in my podcast. And Kevin Kelly, who wrote that post, has been on my podcast twice. But the idea behind his article, and it's one of his most well-known articles, it's a great article, is that if anybody essentially has 1,000 true fans, they can make a living. And he sort of loosely defines what a true fan is and what making a living means. But you kind of just gave an example right there. If there's a vampire author, you might end up spending $40 on that guy. So if 1,000 people, or let's say 2,000 people, buy his books, or he keeps on writing books, he's going to keep on generating, you know, $40 from all these fans, or and basically from every new book, these people are going to buy it, you know, no matter where he prices it.
Yeah, definitely, and I think that's a perfect example that if you have a good enough fiction book, you don't really need a lot of people to buy your books, just a number of loyal followers. With
some, you can probably price a good fiction book higher.
Definitely.
So, like, if I'm in part two of a series that I love, I'm willing to spend $8.95 for the Kindle instead of $2.95 for a nonfiction book that I may or may not spend more for.
Exactly. And I think from what I've seen, a lot of the fiction writers, they do that, where it's $4.99, it's $5.99. They'll bundle their books together. So maybe they'll put four books together and that'll be priced at $9.99. So they do a lot of good kind of compilations and different ways to make sure that their audience is being best served by the best possible price, but also getting their audience to buy as many books as possible.
It's so funny because I always look at and click on random categories to see what's selling. And I was looking at, I went down really granular in some romance category.
Oh boy.
And it was number 900 overall in the whole Amazon store, which has, 6 million titles. It was like number 9 and 10. And but it was only number 120 in like women's literature.
So
like the entire, top 1,000 books. It's like a lot of it is fiction geared towards, women's literature and romance and so on.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to meet a couple of women's romance writers / erotica. And they describe their business model. It's insanely profitable, but it's they describe it almost as insatiable. Their audience just needs to read those books. And if they're not writing a book every month or two, it's what have you done for me lately? So they have to just kind of keep on feeding the beast and getting out those books as quick as possible.
Will they drop off?
They will drop off, they'll lose their audience. So it's a great market, but it's also very insatiable. And I couldn't picture writing, 20 different versions of The Billionaire's Virgin or whatever the book I saw the other day. So it's a great market, but I don't know if I could stomach that kind of pressure.
Well, it gets back to your three Ps. You have to have passion for what you're mm-hmm. writing. So you like the habits nonfiction category and you're doing very well with it. So now we launched free for 5 days and we use that to kind of build our email list. Now we're launching into Kindle. I think your decluttering book is ranked number 210 overall on Amazon. Just how do you consistently keep these books high up on the Amazon ranks? It must mean it's selling well.
There's a couple things I do. So since we last talked, there was almost the launch your book and then hope for a BookBub promotion. And BookBub is pretty much the largest book advertising platform that's out there. And they have what they call featured deals. So they've done a beautiful job of aggregating, I think it's like 40 or 50 different email lists. So if you want to learn about erotica, then you just join that erotica list and you just get price discounts on pretty much a book every single day. So if you can get a featured deal on BookBub, it's a pretty impressive thing. You can sell thousands upon thousands of copies. That was the only real major book advertising platform that was back in 2014. Now we're in 2017, and there's a lot of great book platforms out there. So there's Amazon Ads, and Amazon Ads, I now love it because it's just you could just micro-target the heck out of a book. So
what do you do? Like, how do you do it? So I've seen the Amazon ad, you know, make your ad thing. Mm-hmm. What happens? You click on that.
Yeah, so it's a couple different options. I like the sponsored, I think they call it sponsored products. I know it begins with sponsor. I forget what the second word is, but it's basically you target a keyword or a specific book title or an author. So if I want, which I hate to admit it, I've targeted James Altucher. So I'm like, all right, I'm pretty sure.
Congratulations. I hope they did well for you.
It has. Actually, your books have converted really well. So if I wanted to make sure that my book showed up on Reinvent Yourself, I'll target Reinvent Yourself. And it's a cost per click. So if you're willing to pay 50 cents per click, since someone will see it right at the top, right below the customers also bought, there's another line of books that pretty much just say sponsor posts. And you're basically bidding on a keyword level, cost per click. And
there's the first line, which says people who buy Reinvent Yourself buy Choose Yourself. Then there's the next line, people who buy this product or have viewed this product also viewed these products.
Exactly.
Then there's the sponsored line, which is right below that or above it, I forget. And it's more in italics, and it's like people who are sponsored products related to
exactly.
this product.
Sponsored products.
So I actually often see Patrick King's book or books on my books in that line over there. So you pay for that, and let's say you're paying 50 cents per click or you bid or whatever.
Yeah, so you could, I find that for me, it makes more sense to just go 10 cents per click, which puts me on page 2 or page 3. So I'm not getting enough impressions, but when people do see the book and they do click over, my what they call ACOS, the average cost of sale, is pretty good. So you want to get as a low percentage as possible. So I'm in the 20 to 30% ACOS, which is pretty good. That means that for every 20%, so every like $1 I spend, I'll get about $5 back. And that's gross, not net. And I know that Amazon takes about 30% of that. So I try to keep in the 20 to 30 range because I know that once everyone gets a little bit of their cut, that's the baseline. I know I'll make my money back.
So let's say you figure out the optimal level where you're breaking even. Would you just ramp that up as much as possible?
It's hard if you're going a low cost per click. So if you're just going 10 cents, 15 cents per click, you're just not going to get the impressions. If you could somehow convert 50 cents a click, then yes, absolutely. All day long, I would spend $1,000 just to make $1,100. Mm-hmm. It's hard unless you have a book that sells for $9.99. It's really hard to make your money back if you're spending 50 cents per click, especially on Amazon.
So you basically use that to kind of, again, keep your Amazon rank low, even if it's costing you a little money, but then keeping your Amazon rank low puts you number one in all these categories, which increases your visibility, which increases other people seeing your book.
Exactly. And I know that with also the new thing that's come on the scene in the last couple of years that we haven't really talked about, it's called Pages Read. It's part of the Kindle Unlimited program. And that's just their kind of Netflix model where you pay 10 bucks and authors are compensated on a per pages read. I think it's like half a cent per page. So it's not a lot, especially for nonfiction. But again, it's almost trying to introduce someone to your books and then start to build those 1,000 true fans. And I'm kind of on the fence about Kindle Unlimited. I have my my pros against it and my pros for it and my cons against it. But overall, I like the program. But For the most part, Amazon ads really can help. And there's a couple other platforms that people use as well.
But like what?
There's BookBub partner program. So we talked about BookBub before, where that's the feature deal. They actually just rolled out a program where you could, I forget what they call it. It's a cost per thousand type of program. So you basically pay BookBub on a per impression basis. So you'll say, all right, I will pay you $7 per thousand impressions. And these are the impressions that actually go in their targeted emails that go out. So let's just say I'm trying to target James Altucher readers. I would just say, all right, I want to target the reader of James Altucher books and show this particular banner. And they've done such a good job figuring out their audience and what their audience likes, then they'll just show it to that particular audience. And you could actually break it down with ads that I'll have 10 ads, and each one of those ads targets a different author. And I can kind of figure out, all right, here's one where I don't really pay too much on a per impression basis, and I still make my money back. And this is a little bit data-driven, but I run everything through the Amazon Associates program, which is the kind of affiliate network we mentioned before. But what you can do there is you could create a specific kind of affiliate ID. So the point is you could create affiliate ID for your book, and you know which ones are actually converting. You can just do the math and know, all right, this campaign's profitable and this campaign's not profitable. It's a lot more intensive than Amazon ads, but that's just kind of another way that I'm promoting.
But this
books.
Is important. This is what every marketer does, and you kind of have to be a marketer now.
Yes.
If you're in the self-publishing business, you're essentially your own publishing company, but you're not only the writing department, you're also the marketing department. So this kind of stuff is very important. And I think a lot of traditional book publishing marketing departments don't know this information, and so they're getting blown away by self-published books. I mean, self-published books are selling more than traditionally published books.
I think they're starting to catch on. I've noticed that I've seen a lot of traditionally published books that are starting to use some of the same techniques, but it's almost an area where you have to be kind of scrappy. You have to be willing to sit there and do the grunt work and learn about marketing, test maybe 10 things and one or two will stick. And that's what I personally enjoy about this business is I do like writing, but sometimes I actually enjoy more the marketing side of this because it's data-driven and I can kind of channel my inner geek and figure all this stuff out. And for me, it's like the money, I'm happy with how much money I make. Now it's more of a kind of keeping score. I used to love video games, and now I just keep score with my business.
Well, it's definitely obsessive. Like any writer will tell you, it's definitely obsessive seeing where your Amazon rank is. And if you've written like 68 books, probably you're just all the time reloading your different Amazon pages to see where the ranks are. But again, like with the declutter book and the fact that it's ranked so low, like number 210 or maybe number 150, wherever I've seen it bounce around in the past week, it's amazing to, you know, there's 6 million books in the Amazon store. So it's amazing that you're staying consistently in the top several hundred all the time with at least one or two of your books. And so is this coming from mostly this interplay between ads and being seen? Or, you know, what else, what other tricks do you do?
I would say it actually goes from the beginning. It's a good choice in title, it's a good choice in cover, and it's a good choice in description. That really, if you get that right, your job will be way easier.
So people do judge a book by the cover?
Absolutely, 100%. That's definitely.
How do you test a cover?
One of the ways I test a cover, it's actually two ways. So I have my Facebook groups I mentioned before, and just as a gut level check, I will often just create a quick poll. All right, what do you think of these three titles? What do you think of these three covers? And I'll have people vote on it, but I'm more looking at what the comments are about it. So if someone's like, "Oh, that's a weird idea," or "I really just don't resonate with that particular word choice," so it's more just trying to get a gut level feeling for those choices at that point. And then I try to narrow it down to two titles and two covers. And I use a website called PickFu. That's PickFu.com. And what that does is that just runs a poll to 100 random anonymous people. So they have no skin in the game, and they are, to put it lightly, they are brutally honest about what they like or don't like about your cover and your title. So they'll rip you apart, but I'm kind of looking for that, my butt getting ripped apart, because I know that it's going to make the presentation much stronger. And sometimes you just get it right from out of the gate. The actual, the decluttering book, it's Declutter Your Mind. I actually want to give a full credit. That was actually mostly written by my writing partner, Barry Davenport, and her and I have teamed on a bunch of things lately. And she actually just said, all right, this is the title of the book, and this is kind of what we're talking about. And I kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, okay, and that book turned out turned out great. And we didn't really test it at all. And it's just one book that just kind of stuck. And that was her gut level check. And I just kind of just trusted in her opinion.
Her gut level check on the topic or on the cover, on the...
All of it.
On the title?
On the title, the topic, and just the overall scope of the book. And I kind of... She wrote a good amount of it, and I just edited it and just made sure it kind of followed the flow that I like. And I just kind of picked up the marketing from there. So it was a good team effort.
And what additional thing did you do on the marketing for that one?
Pretty much everything I talked about, just a good proper launch. And then since the book was launched, I tried to support it by trying to get as many reviews as possible. So I'm continuously, whenever I get an email, I say, all right, if you like the book, would you mind leaving a review? So it's almost that day-to-day grind of trying to get reviews on a book as much as possible.
Okay, so Amazon doesn't like it if you directly ask someone for a review. How do you kind of...
The way I interpret that this is just my humble opinion. It's as long as you're not offering incentives. So it's not like if you say, all right, go leave a review in this book and I'll give you a free copy of something else. So it's not incentivized based. It's someone who's already emailed me, expressed interest in reading. They'd already said they liked the book. They got value from it. I just give them a link and say, hey, would you mind just leaving a review here? So that's, in my opinion, if as long as you're not just going out and joining these secret review groups where 20 people review your books and you review 20 other people's, where it's just basically one just massive review exchange. That's where I think Amazon really frowns upon that stuff. But for the most part, my first, I would say 20, 30 reviews, it's just all audience driven. It's all people that are on my email list or my Facebook group. I just say, hey, the book's out. Would you mind leaving a review? And I ask them, but I don't sit there and like track every single book that I gave out for free, make sure every one of them's leaving a review, because I think that's where you start getting in trouble is the expectation, I guess.
And the Amazon algorithm definitely weights books based on the speed by which reviews are coming in, and I guess 5-star reviews.
Definitely.
And one-star reviews hurt the book?
It really depends on the book. I've seen book sales completely tank overnight from just a really well-crafted, scathing one-star review, but then I've also seen books that get a bunch of one-star reviews and it doesn't seem to affect the sale. So I would say it's not necessarily the one-star review. It's the level of how much they rip you a new one and how many other people say, hey, this is a great review. And then suddenly the top-rated review on your book is a one-star review that does a good job of ripping the shreds. That's when you probably start to run in trouble. And that, to be perfectly honest, that's what happened with habit stacking. I didn't do a good enough job writing it. And the top couple of reviews on the book, honestly, they do a good job ripping apart because I didn't do my job as an author to make it as good as possible.
But I don't know, though, Steve, because habit stacking was number one in like the entrepreneurship category forever.
Yeah.
Like I had all of my books banging up against the wall and you were like consistently number one. And you know, I don't care what the reviews were. Like I saw the results. You were there for a long period of time. That was the number one book.
Yeah. I think
you're the number one author in the entire business category.
I guess I have high expectations because the reason I'm actually rewriting the book is I want to make sure the book is as good as possible. So in my head that I've done a pretty good job with the writing, but I don't think I've done an honest, all right, this is the best possible book I can write. So I feel in 2017, if I write the best possible books and combine it with the best possible marketing, then I will have a thriving business that will stand the test of time. Right now, I just feel that my business is too cyclical. It's too up and down.
Why do you think that? Like if you put out, let's say you just kept with the schedule and you kept putting out a book every 2 months, say. So you put out 6 books a year.
Well, the perfectly honest answer is I kind of took 2016 off. I got married, had a kid. I don't think I really worked more than a couple hours in certain months. I just did nothing. And that's just pure laziness on my part.
So let me ask you then, did 2016 start off strong because you were still riding off the earnings from prior books?
It was definitely kind of a peak, a major valley, and another peak towards the end because I think it was August 20th that I partnered with Barry when we released the Declutter Your Mind, and that book really took off over the last couple of months, and in the beginning of 2016 did pretty well from just a couple of previous books, but I would say in the middle part of the year, I was big enough to get by, but it wasn't the massive success I saw in 2014 and now.
So you pretty much have to stick with that, writing a book every, what would you say, 2 months, or what do you have to do?
I would say 2 to 3 months, but what I'm trying to test now is to put more effort into each book and make them almost a small business. So that's why I have gone out and built a website or it's not really a website, it's part of teachable.com, where just instead of one lead magnet, I now have about 10 to 15 different pieces of content laced throughout the book and all of it's just one big value dump at the end that, hey, join this membership area where we have all these little extras to help you take action on what you just learned. They join the website. I get the email address. And then from there, the email sequence tries to add value, but also gets people to leave a review. And also I'll occasionally promote an affiliate product. So this is all theory because I only just released a book a couple weeks ago and I'm just starting to see a little bit of that, a little bit of the results. But my theory is if you actually can build a little mini funnel out of each book, that'll be a more sustainable business over the lifetime instead of just relying on the launch and write strategy, which I've been kind of following for a couple of years.
Or at the very least, again, providing what you call these lead magnets or giveaways in, let's say, the front and the back, and you have to sign up for your email list. At the very least, that email list can be used to market, your next book and so
exactly.
on. And your email list will continue to increase. So for each book, so as you write more and more books, and give away more content, your email list will get bigger. And again, at the very least, you could just market the next book with the email list.
Yeah, at the bare minimum, you could use an email list to get reviews. And that's actually one error I made before is in none of my email sequence that I have go leave a review for this book. It's more like, hey, if you don't mind, go leave a review on one of my books. It was really kind of open-ended. But now they're on a specific list for a specific book they read. They got specifically tailored content to that book. And within that, just a simple review request. So I feel that's going to lead to more reviews down the road, which is, as you and I both know, that's one of the most important aspects of publishing is you got to have as many reviews on your book, or at least a good percentage of reviews.
Well, one publisher of a major publishing company, so the CEO of a major publishing company, once told me that if a book has 1,300 reviews, it's going to last forever. It's like it's basically going to be a classic of some sort, and it's going to keep on going. Do you think that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I think the best example is the book that's, I think, number one overall right now in business is The One Thing by Gary Keller. That book, I don't know I'm pretty sure it has at least 1,900 reviews. I have to fact check that, but I know it has at least 1,000 reviews, and that book has just been selling like gangbusters over the last year. And not only is it because it's a good book, but I think just it does have that review threshold that people look at it. They don't really bother with the one star. They said, all right, well, 1,900 people have left a review. This must be a good book.
Right. I only have, my book Choose Yourself has, I'll tell you the exact number because I always check it. It has 1,769 reviews. And that seems to be perpetual. I'm hoping it's perpetual.
And you've also built a whole brand around the idea of Choose Yourself. So I think that definitely helps. But that one's a monster as well. You can tell that people just buy it just for the simple fact there's a ton of reviews on it.
So there's basically four different skills in terms of building the, let's call it the business you've built up. So you could essentially write these books from home and make a living. There's sort of the idea of picking a topic, a book category, doing the research and writing the book and writing a good book. So that's one skill to develop. The next skill is kind of all the technical stuff that ranges from getting a cover designed, getting it formatted properly for Kindle, editing it, uploading it, and so on. So that's kind of
management.
That could be outsourced a little bit. And then there's the third skill, which is advertising and marketing, knowing all the different kind of advertising avenues, and that will change probably year by year. But there's probably plenty of websites to catch up on that, I'm sure. Or your Facebook's group, Authority Self Publishing, is one place where people could check up on that. And then the fourth skill is kind of building this email list or platform from within your books to help market later books.
Yeah, definitely. I would add, I guess, two things. One of them would be kind of in the management side is delegation. You get to a point where you don't necessarily have to do all this stuff yourself. And I have a virtual assistant who I've trained. She actually runs a lot of my bookmarking campaigns. She kind of knows what she's doing. I've already taught her. I've kind of given her free rein to go make a bunch of mistakes. And I'm not going to get mad at her just because I know that she's trying different things. And she does a great job with that.
Where'd you find her?
Virtualstafffinder.com. That's Chris Ducker's website. It's a VA service based out of the Philippines. But she's been part of my team now for I want to say 3 years now. So she's been great to work with, and she's full time. She's pretty much part of my, I don't say part of my family, but she's definitely a valuable part of what I do online. And I would say kind of the fifth element to this is self education. I'm really a firm believer that don't just assume what worked yesterday will work tomorrow. Like I try to have the practice where I read or do something to learn every single day, at least 30 minutes. And you should just
what's an example?
That habit. Let's see, on the train, I read an article about the different ways to get white hat backlinks to your website. So I'm trying to learn how to build up my blog to the point where that could be kind of its own self-sustaining business in case something happens with my books. I kind of want to have like a contingency plan. So I'm trying to learn about how to build a, not necessarily a blog platform where it's writing myself, but more of a like a content website that I can manage without having to sit there and write every single day. So that's kind of one of my little side projects right now. But that's one example. I know Derek Murphy, he just wrote a book about guerrilla book publishing. That was he's someone I respect. He's a fiction writer and a nonfiction writer. And he wrote a pretty extensive book on book marketing. And odds are I probably will know 90% of it, but I know that there'll probably be that 10% that I haven't thought of that I would like to add to my kind of my marketing engine. So that's something I'll be reading on the train ride home. So I guess the point here is you have to like kind of commit yourself to 30 minutes of just learning something every single day.
So on that note, first, thanks for coming on the podcast. You came
on my pleasure
2.5 years ago because I saw you kind of blast out of nowhere and have all these bestsellers then, and it's still happening now and you're still doing incredibly well. So congratulations on that and getting married and having a kid since I last saw you and all these things. But also, Habit Stacking 2.0, when's that coming out?
That is coming out in early March. Can I give a URL?
Yeah.
Go to habitstackingbook.com.
You know, I also just totally forgot. I wrote the foreword of a book you wrote. You wrote with Hal Elrod and
Andre. You totally forgot about that, yeah.
The Miracle Morning for Writers, which is like Habits in the Morning for Writers. And I wrote the foreword of that book.
Yeah, oh, again, thank
did
you
that
for
that. Did
that
book do well?
Yeah, that book
by
did
writing
pretty well.
It, I, just so you know, I mean, just so the listeners know, I didn't get compensated or anything. I was more than happy to help you and Hal and Andre and so on.
Well, thank you. No, that was a fun experiment. I did it with Hal Elrod. He's the author of The Miracle Morning. I don't necessarily still follow every single thing for The Miracle Morning, kind of my own routine, but I would say I follow a good 50% of it with a bunch of different add-ons, my habit stack. But yeah, that was a really interesting experience because it was like the first time I had a project manager, which was Honor, and she was great to work with. She kind of kicked my butt a little bit in a good way. And they actually had, it was kind of nice. I just wrote the book and I didn't really have to do anything afterwards besides once the book was ready to launch, then I kind of did the stuff that I normally do with a book launch. But it was an interesting perspective on working with someone else who has their own kind of marketing engine in place and see how that did. And I know the book's selling fairly well. I think it's like number 21,000 overall. It's at $9.99, and that's usually not really my sweet spot for a price point. So it's cool kind of latching onto a different platform and seeing what they do behind the scenes. And there's a lot of stuff that I learned from them that I'm now instituting into my marketing playbook.
So what are so again, Steve, thanks for coming on the podcast, and I definitely hope to have you on again in another 2 years to see what's the latest thing that's happening in self-publishing. And I really think this is a valuable topic for people. Like often I would say these podcasts are not 100% as actionable as this one is, but I really do think people should try the methods you've kind of outlined here and check out your website. What's the URL for your website in general?
I have two of them. There's the developgoodhabits.com. That's kind of it's in line with the books. Mm-hmm. And there's also authority.pub. And if you want to learn about self-publishing, that has probably the best content that we have about self-publishing. We have a podcast, but I think we're going to put that on hiatus for a while just so I can focus on the books.
Podcasts are a lot of work.
An insane amount of work. It's more work than I ever imagined. I enjoyed it, but it was very just time conflicting trying to schedule interviews and then talk to people, like what you go through on a regular basis.
Yeah.
It's very hard work. But I would say even just going to authority.pub, there's still a lot of good content that'll show you all the basics. So you can get all the basics that get you up and running on that website. So that might be a good starting point for people listening.
Well, thanks a lot, Steve Scott, the number one business author in the world. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
All right, thanks. Oh, it's been a blast.
So that was great. I think this is so valuable to people.